president has now stopped using the term imminent attack. He simply uses the term disarming, which is quite a different concern.
Why Iraq and why now? And if you want to understand why Iraq and why now, oil really is the key element.
It was a controversial election, so I wasn't surprised by the widespread criticism of George W. Bush. He was just a funny little rich boy with poor public speaking skills.
There are very good reasons that Saddam should be gone, but is that our job to be the world's policeman? And I personally, I don't think it is.
As we speak, George Bush is preparing to send a new generation of young men and women to fight and die for his unjust war overseas.
This is Pacifica's Peace Watch for Thursday, January 23rd, 2003. I'm Verna Avery Brown. Fearful that a possible overthrow of Saddam Hussein may lead to chaos in the region, six of Iraq's neighbors met today to discuss ways to avert a conflict and urge Baghdad to cooperate more with UN arms inspectors. A Turkish diplomat speaking on condition of anonymity says Turkey has proposed that the meeting adopt a joint declaration calling on Iraq to fully cooperate with UN arms inspectors and declare that it will not develop weapons of mass destruction in the future. In another report, a report in the British Guardian newspaper is reporting that the U.S. military has drawn up detailed plans to secure and protect Iraq's oil fields to prevent Iraqi President Saddam Hussein from setting them ablaze, as he did the Kuwaiti oil wells in the 1991 Gulf War. James Paul of the Global Policy Institute at the U.N. in New York is closely following the oil trail around this impending war. Peace Watch spoke with Paul for reaction to reports that the Bush administration is making the oil fields its number one priority.
Well, it certainly isn't surprising news. We've been known all along that oil was the number one issue here. But furthermore, there have been comments coming out of Washington from time to time that the oil fields were going to be a primary target, and they were going to go in and seize those fields in order to make sure that, I suppose, they weren't set fire to. However, it's relatively easy to set fire to oil fields, I believe, through having charges placed in and near the wells. So we just don't know what's going to be the result there.
Are there other plans that have been discovered from the U.S. government or from individuals prior to George W. Bush's administration that indicate that there is, in fact, a full plan intact to secure these oil wells even before the so-called war on terrorism?
Well, there's a lot of scattered evidence about the importance of oil. I think it's the issue of seizing the oil fields directly kind of flows more or less out of the military campaign itself. They don't want to see those fields set fire to, basically, and destroyed in a way that would take a long time for them to bring them back, which was the case in Kuwait in 1991. And so they'll probably try to move right in there right away. It seems a pretty logical thing to do. And in fact, that aspect of the military policy, I don't like this war and I don't like what the UN is U.S. is doing, but I don't, I can't exactly object to them preventing the firing of oil wells per se, you see.
Mm-hmm. What U.S. corporations would play a stake, or have a stake, rather, in future oil plans for Iraq?
Well, there's two corporations in particular that are the major companies now that tower above all the rest, and ExxonMobil is the first of all. ExxonMobil is the, by many measures, the biggest transnational corporation in the world. It's revenues in 2001 were close to $200 billion, and its profits were about $15 billion. It was the largest profits of any transnational company in the world. They're going to be the number one claimant on Iraq's oil, and generally in the diplomatic community, people I talk to say, yes, ExxonMobil is going to be the first to get the best fields, Majnoon and some of these big fields in Iraq. The other one is...
Well, how do we know that?
Well, we have a strong sense of it. We don't know it, but we have a strong sense because they're the number one U.S. company, and the U.S. is going to be in military control of Iraq, and so there's a very, very good chance that the U.S. companies are going to get the first shot at things. We could talk a little bit, if you want, about how that process might work and how it would seem, but let me just mention that the second company is Chevron Texaco, which is the company that Condoleezza Rice was on the board of, and they had a super tanker named after her and so on. So that's the number two company, and we expect that they're also going to play a big role in Iraq after the war.
We want to play an excerpt of an interview Peace Watch producer Reem Khatuta conducted when Congress went back into session a few weeks ago, and then we'll get your response.
All right.
This is Henry Bonilla, a Republican representative from Texas.
Only foolish people who are generally anti-Bush are the ones who are spreading rumors about this being a conflict over oil. This is about national security. It's about biological warfare. It's about weapons of mass destruction. It's about a ruthless leader who has killed millions of his own people and is amassing a lot of weaponry to use against the West.
James Paul, your reaction to that. How much would you say oil factors into the Bush administration's plans to invade Iraq?
I think oil is a very, very big factor. There's a number of dimensions to the oil issue. There's oil as a military and geostrategic resource that's very important to the Pentagon. There's the issue of the direct control over Iraqi oil and the literally several trillion dollars of profits that the big companies can expect out of that. And thirdly, there's Iraq's oil resources as part of the world oil scene and the world oil market, and how it is that when they get in control of Iraq's oil, that's going to help towards the privatization of oil in Saudi Arabia and Iran and Venezuela and other places, which is a trend that's beginning right now in an important way. So oil plays itself out in a number of ways, but this denial we have to look at in two ways. One is, do the arguments that this congressman or anyone else in Washington, they're making arguments about what they say the reasons are. And I think we've been discussing for a long time how hollow those arguments are, the argument about weapons of mass destruction when they actually helped Saddam Hussein acquire chemical and biological weapons and helped him target those weapons onto, you know, Kurdish and Iranians, military targets and so on. This is complete rubbish and ruthless leader. Well, how many times has Washington supported ruthless leaders and so on? So,
what about national interest? Well, that's another argument that Representative Bonilla made specifically.
Well, yes, but when you get right down to it, what do they think in Washington? What is the national interest? The national interest is oil. And you know, it's projected onto a broader scene, so that there's, you might call an imperial interest of the United States that goes beyond any single region and beyond any single resource. And certainly, that's an element in the picture and in the strategy that they have. But the question here is, well, why Iraq, and why now? And if you want to understand why Iraq and why now, oil really is the key element to understanding the intensity of the push towards war at this point. Furthermore, I wanted to just add one other thing, and that is the denial of oil as being an interest is something we can see. I was just reading some historical material about Britain in the 1920s, and in the British Parliament, Lord Curzon, the British Foreign Minister, was accused of Britain's position in Iraq as being motivated by oil, and he wrote a series of letters to the Times of London saying, nonsense, oil has nothing to do with it. But now, after many years, the cabinet minutes are available to us. We can see what they were really thinking and saying, and it's quite clear that oil was the interest. So the idea that people in government deny this is not persuasive.
What about the role of France? We're hearing reports where Secretary of State Secretary of War Donald Rumsfeld is basically saying that France's decision not to support the U.S.'s war agenda, it could perhaps be based on the fact that France has struck some sort of deal with Saddam Hussein around the oil fields. And if oil is a factor, it must be a factor on both sides of the equation, those for the war and those against it. Your thoughts about that?
Well, yes, I think that's very, very much to the point. We've been reading about how the Russians and the French have this insidious oil interest in Iraq. And then, but when it comes to the United States and the UK, of course, they don't have an oil interest in Iraq. I actually run across delegates from the different countries here around the UN, and that's a common theme that we hear from the UK and the US delegations. They love to say, isn't it shocking how the French have this oil interest? And I suppose they think that we haven't noticed that maybe the US has an oil interest, or the UK has an interest in Iraqi oil as well. So, yes.
And to all those protesters who carry signs, no blood for oil, you say what, Jim Paul?
I say, you're right on target. That's it. And I'm really delighted that the oil issue is getting out more and more. There's been a front page story on this in Der Spiegel last week in Germany. There's been a number of the Christian Science Monitor is in the process of doing a big story on this. It's getting out, and that's good because it's the heart of the matter.
James Paul of the Global Policy Institute at the United Nations in New York. A rift has been created between the U.S. and several of its traditional European allies on the question of whether to attack Iraq. Among the harshest critics of the Bush administration's plans are France and Germany. And with Germany due to take leadership of the U.N. Security Council next month, the opposition is growing more significant. It culminated yesterday with the two countries joining together to block U.S. war plans and prevent NATO from helping the U.S. launch attacks. Reinhard Hess, an advisor to German Chancellor Gerhard Schroeder, spoke with the BBC.
It's clear that Germany and France see it as their obligation to work in common and in the international institutions in a coordinated manner to prevent war and to preserve peace. And I think there's no difference with the British government at this point. We're all working to find a non-war solution that includes disarming Iraq and excluding the danger of weapons of mass destruction in the hands of a brutal dictator. So there's no difference in the points of view on that. And I think this is the point which we have to respect at this moment, that we are in the phase, we have the inspectors. Germany has just dispatched another experts group of about 20 persons and some equipment to facilitate the inspectors' task. And I think this is what we should concentrate on at this point. Nobody is ready to draft a resolution which would call for a Security Council to empower anybody to go to war.
German advisor Reinhard Hess. Arab and Muslim foreign leaders meeting in Istanbul today voiced opposition to a U.S. war in Iraq, but put the onus for peace squarely on Iraqi shoulders. Meeting in an Ottoman palace on the banks of the Bosphorus, the foreign ministers of Turkey, Syria, Egypt, Saudi Arabia, Jordan, and Iran asked Saddam Hussein to comply fully with U.N. weapons inspectors to avoid a war. But as Aaron Glantz has more from Amman, Arab men and women are showing their opposition with their pocketbook.
We're in the office of Dr. Hisham Bustani. The Jordanian dentist has been to prison 5 times in the last 2 years. He's active in the Jordanian Civil Liberties Committee, the Committee Against War in Iraq, and the leading organization against normalized relations between Jordan and Israel. All three organizations have been banned by Jordan's King Abdullah. These days, Dr. Bustani spends most of his time out of the office organizing a boycott of American and Israeli goods in Jordan. He says he's eliminated most American drugs from his practice.
Myself, I made some adjustments now. Now I rarely use American materials or medicines. Or, for example, now we don't deal with, for example, with Lilly, Pfizer, I think 3M products. All of these, I don't deal with them. And I shifted to European, Japanese, based products. Medicines, we do have a strong Jordanian medicines a good line of medicines, good manufacturers, so we've shifted to the Jordanian medicine.
But the big targets are the signature American brands, Coca-Cola, Pepsi, McDonald's, and Burger King. The boycott has been most effective in Saudi Arabia, where American imports fell by a massive 25% last year. Ehab Jaradad is a 28-year-old Palestinian nurse living in Yemen. He no longer buys American goods.
It's impossible for me to deal with a soldier, American soldier. I can't accept him to be in my land. I mean Jordan only. All over the Arab world, they have no right to be here. Most of us are suffering from what America doing in us, supporting Israel, trying to attack Iraq. Even they want to learn us how to be good Muslims. They want to delete some God's words in our Holy Quran, which talks about jihad or fighting the enemy. So I think all peoples hate America. Most of us hate America. And I repeat here that we are talking about the government, not the peoples, not the citizens.
The American companies are fighting back. In Egypt, the Coca-Cola company has sued the boycott organizers for defamation and asked the government to throw the organizers in prison. In Jordan, the boycott campaign itself is illegal. Again, Palestinian nurse Ehab Jaradad.
Even they put in jail many people because of that. You can't announce that you are against that. It's popular between me and you and other people. So we can do that without any announcement, without any paper, just between us. Or sometimes they're using the websites for boycott, but not officially. You can't go to the television and say, don't use that. It's forbidden here.
And yet Arabs continue to turn away from American products. This has meant new markets for Arab entrepreneurs, says Dr. Hisham Bustani.
We have seen an Arab businessman in France putting up the Mecca cola, he called it, as a drink, and he's gaining markets. We have seen the Iranian, it's called Zamzam cola, in the Gulf markets, it's emerging very well. We have seen here the Syrian drinks coming in Jordan, emerging very well.
In the end, Dr. Bustani admits it will be difficult to bring down the American companies or directly affect the Bush administration's policies in the Middle East. Dr. Bustani says the main point of the boycott is to get the attention of the American people.
The main problem, first of all, is the U.S. imperialism around the world. I think the American public should become more aware of the foreign policy of their administration, should become more aware of the destructive manner in which it intervenes all around the world for the benefit of no one but the military industrial complex in the United States, for the military of people like Bush, for Rumsfeld. And I think that the major part of resisting the U.S. imperialism is in the United States, through the our brothers, the United States, the people of the United States.
For Pacifica's Peace Watch, I'm Aaron Glantz in Amman, Jordan.
When President Bush dismissed UN Security Council calls to give the weapons inspection team more time in Iraq and characterized Baghdad's position as a, quote, rerun of a bad movie I'm not willing to watch, unquote, he ratcheted up the rhetoric for war, signaling to the world he's ready to go ahead with or without others' approval. Legal analysts say if the U.S. launches an attack unilaterally against Iraq, it would be against international law, and some say it would be illegal. U.S. Congresswoman Sheila Jackson Lee of the 18th District in Texas spoke with Peace Watch yesterday regarding this question and the resolution she has submitted to Congress seeking to repeal the president's power to wage war against Iraq.
I think what the legal analysts are suggesting is that under the accords of the United Nations and the laws governing the United Nations, of which the United States has willingly conceded to or consented to, they are a member of the United Nations. We are, in fact, a member of the UN Security Council. Our fellow allies, China, Russia, and France, have veto power. We have consented to that. And the evidence of that in this recent past, of course, is the Gulf War 1991, where President Bush I methodically worked to secure the participation of the allies through the United Nations. What would be in violation, or what we would be in violation of, therefore, would be, I believe, United Nations accords and international laws that we have consented to. With respect to the president's role in the United States, however, it is clear that the president serves as the commander-in-chief of the United States military and can make determinations according to the War Powers Act that the United States is about to be imminently attacked. It is a sharp difference to where we stand today. We have no evidence, and in fact, the president has now stopped using the terms, if you've been listening to him, of imminent attack. He simply uses the term disarming, which is quite a different threat or quite a different concern than it would be for the United States to be in jeopardy. So certainly I think the Congress could raise question as to whether or not we have actually declared war in the instance of a simple question of disarming. In fact, the administration has gone through several stages. It was imminent attack in October when we were, in essence, forced to debate this and vote on it, the fear of imminent attack, the fear of national security, or threat to national security. Since that time, we've heard the words regime change, which those of us who follow policy know that the United States has never made a definitive step or change toward regime change, which means using forces to topple other governments. Now we hear that it is disarming. So I think that at least, minimally speaking, my resolution, H. Res. 2, would allow the Congress to re-debate these issues and to be able, whether you voted yes or no, to fairly understand what the administration, what the president, what his basic premise is for using the United States military. And I think minimally, the United States Congress, that represents the people of the United States collectively, has a right to know.
So is my understanding, Congresswoman, that you're saying that it would not be illegal, but it would be in violation?
What I would say is that I think it would be in violation of international law. I don't believe that one could hold the president as being in violation of domestic law, because he does have, in fact, the War Powers Act, and he could represent that he thought that we were under imminent attack. The War Powers Act allows the executive to move forward to defend the United States and report back to the Congress within 60 days.
So if the Congress is not comfortable with the president acting in violation of international law, what strategies or what options would it have to prevent that from happening?
Well, the good news is that the United States has a democracy, and the constitutional government has three equal branches of government, the judiciary, the Congress, and the presidency. I think that if Congress took up the debate on what the president was doing, you can be sure that the president would be engaged in serious lobbying and serious convincing and having to put forward, with, of course, all respect for classified information, his leadership of the administration to convince the Congress again that they were on the right track on behalf of the United States. So I think it would be valuable to have the question raised as to whether or not the president was, in fact, following the laws that we consented to under the United Nations, or the procedures that we consented to, which is to work with the UN Security Council. Therein you have the opportunity for Congress to debate it again. Is the president, in fact, following the right path, working within the confines of international law, and also working toward goals that we could destabilize or disarm Iraq without war? And many people think that's possible.
Congresswoman, Reuters News is actually reporting that there's an unnamed high-placed military official believes that the United States has already have plans to attack Iraq in mid-February. Is your legislation on the fast track?
Well, I would hope that the legislation gets some attention. I'm going to be sending out, and we have already sent out, what we call Dear Colleague letters to secure support. I certainly will raise this issue on the floor of the House, and we'll see what happens. But I think this legislation was meant to be provocative. It was meant to have people think about whether we're going in the right route or right direction. But I think there's been some momentum by the very fact that we're seeing some of the numbers that reflect the American people's position already showing signs of a different perspective when 60% or more individuals want the UN inspectors to have more time. And my resolution, has as part of its language the fact that the UN inspectors have not finished their work, and we should allow that to happen.
U.S. Congresswoman Sheila Jackson Lee of the 18th District in Texas.
You going, said the man at his desk. Oh, I'm going to a new world, said the child. And he stood, and he stood, and he stood, and 'twere well that he stood. I'm going to a said the child, and he stood. Oh, I'm sounding drums of war, said the man at his desk. Oh, I will not fight your war, said the child, and he stood, and he stood, and he stood, and 'twere well that he stood. Oh, I will not fight your war, said the child, and he stood. Oh, but don't you love your country, said the man at his desk. Yes, I do, but you don't, said the child, and he stood. And he stood, and he stood, and 'twere well that he stood. I do, but you don't.
Stephon Smith, The Bell. Poet, political activist, and professor of African American studies, Nikki Giovanni's activism has stirred a generation and continues to call peace-loving Americans to be more than they are. Recently, we asked her about the impending war on Iraq and what she thought Dr. Martin Luther King would think of the U.S. policy in the Middle East.
I think it's a bad idea, and I don't think this is a good way to jumpstart the economy. I know that Bush thinks the economy can be jump-started by the war because he's offering tax deductions on, they call it the double taxation, on the dividends. So what he's saying is if we go to war, we will, of course, buy weapons, all of the money that makes, plus all of the people we're pulling in, mm-hmm. and all of the people we're going to remove from America. And it'll be okay because the war itself is a jump-start to prosperity. So I think that he's counting on it. But I think it's not right.
Mm-hmm.
It's just not right. Saddam Hussein is a CIA creation. They created Saddam like they created bin Laden, and they did it to fight other things, and now they have a straw dog and they want to knock him down. I think it's not right.
What do you think Dr. King would say about this impending war with Iraq if he were alive today?
Well, I think it's really clear. That is not a thought. King's already said the war is a stupid, bad idea. He said it better than that. And he also pointed out that an eye for an eye leaves everybody blind. But Bush wants to fight in Iraq because of money. Some of it's ego, I'm sure, but a lot of it is controlling the golf course for oil. And he doesn't mind sacrificing my son, your son, and the sons of some poor whites to make that happen. Mm-hmm. So he calls up the reserves because he knows if he starts a draft, there'll be a reaction. The rich white boys don't want to be drafted to go over to fight a war in Vietnam over oil so that Ken Lay can, what, buy another mansion?
The Song of the Feet. It is appropriate that I sing the Song of the Feet. The weight of the body and what the body chooses to bear fall on me. I trampled the American wilderness, forged frontier trails, outran the mob in Tulsa, got caught in Philadelphia, and am still unreparated. I soldiered on in Korea, jungled through Vietnam, sweated out Desert Storm, carved my way through Afghanistan, tunneled the World Trade Center. And on the worst day of my life, walked behind JFK, shouldered MLK, stood embracing Sister Betty. I wiggle my toes in the sands of time, trusting the touch that controls my motion, basking in the warmth of the embrace Days End offers with warm, salty water. It is appropriate that I sing the praise of the feet. I am a black woman.
Nikki Giovanni, political activist and professor of African American studies at Virginia Tech University. That was The Song of the Feet from her most recent collection, Quilting the Black-Eyed Pea, speaks of our continuing struggle. You're listening to Pacifica's Peace Watch. I'm Verna Avery Brown. We'll be back in a moment.